This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Hello, and welcome to the third and final episode of our series on authoritarian neoliberalism for urban political. Please do go back and listen to the previous episodes if you haven't. This kind of follows on from the first two. The first two kind of looked at an authoritarian term within kind of neoliberal urban politics and development practices. And now we're kind of trying to think about how that might be extending and changing into the future. So my name is Gareth Thurn. I work at the University of Manchester, and I've got four excellent guests here today who are going to try and help me discuss these kind of issues, right? So first we have Jason Uger, who is an assistant professor at Northumbria University. Hello, Jason.
Hey, Gareth. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. And we have Aishagul Chan, who is a postdoctoral researcher at Karlsruhe Institute of Technology in German.
Hello, Gareth. I'm happy to be here.
And we also have Oksana Zaporoshets, who is a senior research fellow at the Leibniz Institute for Regional Geography in Leipzig.
Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here.
And last but not least, we have Miklos Dürr, who is the head of the junior year at Marsden Institute and was previously a PhD researcher at Durham University.
Hi, Gareth, and hello, everyone. Thank you so much for having me on board.
Great. Yeah, well, yeah, thank you all for taking the time to join us as well and share, you know, your research and insights. So, yeah, so in the previous episodes, like I say, we talked about an authoritarian term kind of within, you might say, neoliberal development, right? So particularly in the last sort of 10 or 15 years, where we've had kind of top-down sort of authoritarian politics from sort of urban states and sort of national states as well. You know, perhaps directly for the interests of real estate developers or for sort of bigger national projects. And we've kind of discussed like a lack of accountability or democratic control, but also how that's kind of rooted in the history of kind of neoliberal kind of politics anyway, right? It's not some sort of necessarily novel or new thing, but maybe it's intensified more recently. I think we're going to try and talk a bit about today is whether this even amounts to something new, right? Whether we can even call this liberal anymore in any sort of real sense. Like, you know, authoritarianism is not necessarily new to kind of neoliberal politics. Like I say, you think of, you know, Augusto Pinochet, Thatcher in the UK, these kind of like authoritarian and neoliberal sort of sections or ideas kind of together and practices together. And, you know, given that we've kind of had in a period, certainly in like the global north of like crisis and stagnation, it's perhaps not a surprise to see these things becoming more reanimated, right? These kind of tendencies. But is something more like also happening, right? The kind of high point of neoliberal hegemony was associated also with sort of technocratic, sometimes even obscure kind of market systems, things like sustainable development, participation, even consensus, right? So even if these things were highly circumscribed and not particularly, you know, widespread, but even now, like sort of self-described liberals are kind of rejecting liberalism in some form, right? Because it's too, certainly in the Anglophone world, woke, or because it produces too much regulation, or because the state is like, you know, too burdensome, right? So it's a kind of, in some ways, rejection of that kind of, even that neoliberal type of state, right? So we look at some new urban projects today, right? Those envisaged by kind of leading powers seems to be less room for markets, less room for a regulatory state, less room for kind of woke nonsense like climate breakdown. And just a more naked focus on mega projects or kind of real estate, you know, large real estate investments, regardless of social ecological cost. We'll probably talk about this today, but you think of an example could be like NEOM in Saudi Arabia, and also kind of tech oligarchs fantasizing about kind of charter on the kind of network cities, right? And both of these kind of are visions that are based on the rejection of any sort of liberal state at all. So how do we understand this tendency? Like scholars have called this illiberalism. Hendrickse calls it neo-illiberalism, right? Kind of fusing these two things together. Some of that comes from politicians as well, self-describing as illiberal. And I guess it's a question of like, you know, which of these terms and how we actually describe these terms, how we actually describe the current moment. And, you know, at the moment we're looking at a world where we've got state-backed vigilantes and militarized kind of policing agencies attacking kind of peaceful citizens in LA, Istanbul, Delhi. And many have turned to calling this plainly what they see it as fascism, right? You know, going beyond illiberalism. Well, if it's a liberal, it's kind of fascistic, right? That maybe not in the same way as we understood it in the 20th century. So I think whatever we call it, I think we can be fairly clear that there's a turn to insulate power and wealth from the constraints of bothersome institutions like courts. But getting to grips with specifically how this works, particularly through the city, which I think is a central site for these sort of contestations and battles, is what we're going to try and do today, right? So I think what I might start with, if I can go to high school first, maybe, you've wrote recently with Hugh Fanton, you argued for a concept of, sort of neoliberal authoritarian urbanism based on studies of Istanbul and Sao Paulo, and you highlight how the violence enacted by sort of state finance, real estate market coalitions, what you term them, accentuates already existing kind of accumulation by dispossession, or, you know, in connection between sort of local and kind of global actors, right? So maybe you could explain a bit about this concept and what you were trying to get at in that work, and you know, how you see it is, you know, the extent to which you see it as like a just an intensification of what came before, or is it like burgeoning maybe into something new?
Yeah, of course, I can do that. And thank you for the question. In that particular paper, or overall, what my co-author and I tried to do was to first bring the idea of authoritarianism and connect it with neoliberalism in a way within the urban context, because I think I see myself as a geographer and an urban planner, depending on the context, I would suppose. Authoritarianism has always become the kind of concept that no one would like to touch, even though we could see the tenets of authoritarian practices in the space. And that would be one way to explain it. And in addition to that, we have seen, especially in the early 2000s up until now, in countries like Brazil, Turkey, some other countries in the global south, and now maybe some other countries in the global north as well, neoliberalism, or the ideology of neoliberalism, does not necessarily mean anything liberal. It usually, now that as we see it, especially in the urban context or the layout, it means picking and choosing certain market forces and connecting them with the authoritarian urban special practices. So this is why we kind of wanted to bridge the two, actually the three concepts, neoliberalism, authoritarianism, and urban, and come up with this somewhat neoliberal authoritarian urbanism. That was the idea behind it. It's not new. It is things that have been happening for decades now, obviously. We accentuate the bridge and the connection between these kind of concepts. And the way we saw it is actually, it was mostly about a person's or a group's because we saw it as a social class project, ability to use capitals to allow them like a privilege to make space and own space. And by that, these kind of self-interested choices and, you know, this power making or make power making in the space make them look maybe natural or reasonable in a way that could say that maybe there is no alternative. But at the same time, in the field of space where it's contested and where the all forms of capital are very much connected to spatial power, it would be unfair in our intellectual process. It would be unfair to say that this has nothing to do with what's going on within the state and the authoritarian, or maybe less than democratic, if we don't want to use that context or all that concept, less than democratic aspects of the state imposing power on space for profiting or for making a certain class or a group of people richer, more powerful, and etc. So it's kind of that's why we wanted to use these concepts. And in a way, I have to say this because especially in certain conferences and certain debates that I go into, we do not think authoritarianism as something that has an essence in the urban space. It's a set of practices. So, which is why I think that, you know, you can have authoritarian practices in the urban space in any country in the world. So you can have some liberal practices in Turkey or in China or in whatever state that you deem more authoritarian, or you can have illiberal practices in Germany or in UK or I was going to say United States, but I guess that's not as considered as democratic anymore. So I will hold my tongue there. So in a way, that's what we wanted to say with that concept. And I mean, for the second part of the question, that if there's a limit or if it's, I think it's just the intensification of what has been happening, because as you mentioned in your introduction, there's a rise in right-wing politics, and obviously that is feeding into or has been feeding into in the urban development policies and urban policies themselves as well. Even here in Germany, when we talk about elections, we see that how the very far-right political party, AfD, is on the rise, doubling their votes and et cetera. And so in a way, it's just an accentuation of what has been happening in the world is there a limit to it? I cannot say, to be honest, but I don't, considering or seeing where things are going in the world, I think it will be happening, and it will be increasingly happening for a while, because it seems like we are seeing the somehow the fall of certain neoliberal policies, the collapse of certain neoliberal policies or urban development policies that had maybe a more democratic tinge to it. But now there is a very brutal way of conducting urban development all around the world, and especially in countries that are more in the global south, where land speculation or evictions or displacements can be carried out with very little opposition, or the kind of opposition that you can just crash and no one's going to really say something about it because there are so many other problems that are going on.
Yep. That was a really, 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 really great answer. And I think you touched on a lot of important things. I mean, I feel like one of the things that seems to come up, and I think if you're thinking about, I guess, neoliberal policies over a period of time, right, one of the things perhaps they've done is weakened oppositional forces, right? I mean, that seems to be another thing, right? That, you know, whether that's trade unions or political movements or whatever, there's that kind of longer durée as well, I guess. So like when the same, maybe similar sort of practices that were put in place 20 years ago come are reused, perhaps there's less, you know, it's harder for groups of people to resist it. And maybe that's actually, maybe that kind of feeds into what I was thinking about asking Jason, actually, which is that you both, so in the special issue that as a sort of inspired these doing these podcasts, you and Mikos, in your paper, you kind of not treating a liberal kind of politics as a kind of absence of liberalism or even its opposite, right? It's a kind of actually becoming more of a, I think the sort of term you use roughly is like the default option for development in a lot of urban space, whether that's Manhattan or Dubai or, you know, across the world, right? It's not located particularly to a particular place. So when you say liberalism becoming more of a default, right? How is this kind of, what is this, how do you distinguish that from kind of the maybe more typically neoliberal, or like, what is it you're trying to kind of emphasize there when you say that?
Yeah, thanks. That's a really good question. And I think it's something that I'm always grappling with. What is new? Because certainly neoliberalism has always had illiberal outcomes and tendencies, and has always used brutal mechanisms for security and discipline. So that's not necessarily new, right? Like David Harvey's written for decades about how weaponized the responses will be to protect capital in various forms. And certainly we're seeing that now, the protection of capital through various brutal techniques and technologies. I think a couple things maybe are different. One of the things that we tease out in our paper is the speed of platformed urbanism that is a new speed. And it does allow for different kind of combinations and hybridities to form that haven't been the case before. The comings together and relations of regimes online and offline. I mean, that's a reality now that simply didn't exist 20 years ago. And also the sort of illiberal logic of the algorithms themselves and the operation of the platforms. There's really not any room for democracy or participation or, you know, consensus, the kind of buzzwords of democracy. There's no room for that really in platformed urbanism. And I've written in other papers the way that platforms operate like authoritarian states, insofar as they are for-profit entities with certain individuals at the top. With certain ideologies, we can call them techno-feudalists, I think is the buzzword right now. I won't name any names, right? Elon Musk and others. But the sort of extractive mechanisms of the platforms almost operate like extraterritorial states, kind of extra statecraft. That's a new formation, right? It's a new configuration of capitalism, or something that's even post-capitalism, if McKinsey work is to be taken seriously, the kind of extraction of information more so than extraction of value in a traditional sense. So it's a new kind of capitalism that looks very different, and maybe neoliberalism is not the right word to use for that. So that's one thing that's changed. I think the other is the very obvious change of global power dynamics. And, you know, we can no longer use the kind of binary that was always reductionist, but the binary of the illiberal East or the democratic West. I mean, that was, it was always problematic to use that, right? And quite colonialist. But I think now the sort of hybrid regimes we're seeing really show that those binaries don't work. And as Khan said, yes, you're just as likely to see illiberal mechanisms and processes and things borrowed from other regimes showing up in London or New York or Berlin or Tokyo. We're talking about technologies often, forms of surveillance, et cetera. And maybe the final thing I would say is the degree to which explicitly illiberal ideologies, which used to be maybe on the fringe 20, 30, 40 years ago, the domain of kind of extremist think tanks, very well funded always, but extremist think tanks and policy groups, that has been upscaled and has really found itself embedded in mainstream urban policy now. And that's been a deliberate project of the far right, really since the John Birch Society, you know, talking about the 1960s. We've seen almost a victory of that ideology in the sort of destruction of the administrative state, the logic of Silicon Valley capitalism, but also ideologies like Christian nationalism, Hindu nationalism, Hebrew nationalism in Israel. You know, there's a theocracy that I think it thinks beyond just profit, right? That there's a sort of a messianic ideology behind some of this too. And a new ideas about gender and nationalism, protectionism, a return to the protectionist nation state. So yeah, all these, maybe these three ways are all sort of poking critiques at saying maybe it's not just authoritarian neoliberalism. Maybe there's also something new that's forming. So yeah, I'll wrap it up there.
Yeah, yeah, excellent. Okay, yeah, yeah. No, I think that's really important. I think that kind of, actually, the next, probably the next two questions I'm going to ask actually really refer to this kind of, and maybe we'll focus on this now, is this kind of the digital platform kind of aspect to this, to politics, both urban and otherwise, really. And I think the authoritarian, as you argue, is like really intertwined with that. So maybe, Oksana, maybe I'll come to you then next, then, in that, obviously, you write a lot about Russia and, as Jason said, you know, we can't make binaries like these kind of East-West binary. It's kind of redundant, but if it ever was any use in the first place. But I think we can, I think it's probably still fair to say that Russia has obviously had a much more established and kind of resilient kind of form of a kind of authoritarian power for much longer than perhaps the other contexts we're talking about in a very distinct way. What I think is interesting with your work is how you kind of explain and the way in which you show how the Russian state has attempted to use and manipulate digital technologies in order to maintain its kind of legitimacy or find new ways of kind of establishing legitimacy in this context, right? So maybe that's, if you could speak a bit about that, like how have sort of digital technologies, particularly in urban space, right, been used to kind of maintain and even sometimes contest, right, the state power in Russia?
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for your question. And talking about Russia, you mentioned it's one of the longest standing authoritarian regimes. And I think it's not the type of longevity we hope for, but still it is like it is. And talking about Russia, and Aysegül mentioned that today it goes without saying that there are liberal practices in democratic regimes and vice versa. But I think when people are talking about Russia, there is like a tendency to demonize or to exoticize some experiences. And what I particularly like in introduction to special issue is the idea that no types of authoritarian neoliberalism are homogeneous. So there are like some temporal development and there is also some spatial heterogeneity in like these regimes. And I think it's like really important when we are talking about Russia to remind ourselves that like in 2018, there were mass protests on the streets of major Russian cities. So it was not always like that. And also there are still like in Russia, some cities which we can call enclaves of democracy, so which have like really huge tradition of opposition to federal government. They cannot oppose openly anymore, but still there are ways. So like not exoticizing situation, it's like one of the options. And also, I think that Russian experience is quite typical for authoritarian, neoliberal urbanism. So because like many things that are mentioned in the introduction actually could be found in Russian experience. The role of the state, checked. The role of alliances, like in urban development or profiting from urban development, checked. The discrimination or like the prohibition of alternative political voices, like double checked. Very well done. So I think Russia, obviously, it's like the school for like best authoritarian practice, and like many regimes like around the world are actively adopting that. But on the same time, Russia is heterogeneous and quite typical. So that's like the first point. The second point, you were asking about digital, and thank you so much for your question, because we actively use digital technologies in our everyday life, but when it comes to our research, we like tend to forget about them. So, and I was studying digital technologies and how urban citizens in general interact with the state using digital technologies, and I focus mainly on everyday life. I was studying how the state appears or is enacted through mundane social and material practices. And I suggest that digital technologies actually play a crucial role in maintaining state legitimacy by integrating into the people everyday routine. So, and the technologies I discuss, they contribute significantly to perceiving the state not as a repressive apparatus, but rather as a service provider, like a type of everyday life. In doing so, like these digital technologies actually kind of fetishize the state, making it appear like, in my words, like an Uber for bureaucratic issues. Something that is fast, that is convenient, and it's effective. That's really where like the danger comes from. I don't know if you are quite familiar with Russian situation, because we can refer like to other countries because like we know quite a lot about them, but let me explain like a bit of Russian situation. So like these digital technologies play a really important role in routinizing like the interaction with the state. And I would like to refer to state services, like maybe the most popular digital app in Russia. And actually, it's the app for almost any type of state services, like want to register your property, easy. Check your kids' school grades, like, please. Want to make a doctor appointment, like, well done. So, like, want to file for a divorce, even, easy. So that's the idea, like, almost all spheres of life or everyday life are covered by this app. And it's like easy to apply, it's really fast, and in many cases, it's effective. And also these types of app, they are operating not only at the national scale, but also at the local level. And in these types of app, you can, for example, report to some issues like leaking pipes, like holes on the roads, like whatever. So, but the idea is the same. They are gradually becoming like the part of everyday life. And they are taken without like any considerations and without questions. The funny thing is that maybe you know that in 2022, many people left Russia because of the disagreement with the state. And when these people moved to other countries, like democratic countries. So the idea is that they are missing this efficiency and this speed of the state app, saying regime is awful, but the apps are fine. Apps are good. So that's how like the state gets depoliticized via app. That's how the interaction with the state gets routinized. But obviously, this interaction is not going only top down, but also we can talk about like bottom up or like citizen led digital infrastructures, and they are quite massive and quite diverse. I would say there is like a really lots of digital ecosystem developed by urban citizens. Usually they were initiated to discuss and to solve like some local problems, like some of them I mentioned. But apparently they developed in something bigger, like in some big cities, these digital apps, like groups in social media, in VK mainly, Russian analog of Facebook, so this digital ecosystem, and also sometimes they are connected to big chats in messengers like Telegram or WhatsApp. So this digital ecosystem, they definitely are used by local citizens to contest, to represent their interests, and like, for instance, to protest against some development or to file some complaints about urban authorities. So they could be used for some like protest means. But at the same time, when local residents are trying to solve like their local issues, they quite often refer to the state on these citizen-initiated platforms, which means so when they are discussing how to solve problem, they provide a link to state apps, or they are discussing like the right way how to file like a complaint to the state, so like some general procedures. So, and that's how being developed for discussing local issues, sometimes being in opposition to the state, these platforms also kind of demonstrate loyalty to the state, which makes the whole situation really ambivalent and difficult like to deal with. So because like opposing in on one hand and supporting on the other hand. And I think that's like really important to keep that in mind, like this duality when we are talking about experience of authoritarian state. Maybe the last thing that I want to mention, and it's not only about digital. So the idea is that what defines Russia now, as although I mentioned that it's a kind of like typical neoliberal authoritarian state or like urbanism, but what really defines Russia now, it's military orientation. That's the country at war, and obviously some state priorities were shifted before the beginning of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022, like lots of resources were aimed on urban development, on different like urban projects. Now it's not like that, but still it's also the classic way of imperialism to annex the territory and to start urban development on the annexed territory. So like contemporary Russian developers are kind of natured, like, so they're kind of empowered by these new territories that Russia recently invaded. So yeah, that's all from my side. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Yeah, that was really interesting. I think this digital, and also just in general, how a more authoritarian regime is able to keep legitimating itself, right? And I think that's a really important question. So we can come back to a minute. I just wanted to go maybe first to Miklos, because I know your work also touches on like digital, and maybe it's related to questions of legitimacy, like Ozona was talking about in a paper you wrote for Urban Studies a few years ago, and focus a bit more, I guess, on the sort of more draconian, that's the word I'm looking for, aspects of kind of digital use by the state as well, right? Which is still ties into legitimacy, I think. You wrote about the liberal smart city in Hungary and digital surveillance being used to securitize the state against crime and then often kind of racialized kind of threat. I just wanted to ask you about this kind of intersection of sort of technology, kind of right-wing populism, and, you know, in the case of the work, sort of explicit kind of discrimination, maybe touching on this question of whether this marks something new. Is it building a kind of new coalition, or is it just sort of defending existing kind of wealth and privilege? And also, I guess, thinking of, well, as well of your paper that you wrote with Jason for the issue too.
Thanks a lot for that question. It's really good. And I think incredibly important to unearth some of those novelties, because starting from this really sort of conceptual overview, I do feel that the what is new question really helps us understand how long-standing and established relations between different sorts of actors in the state and capital have been sort of working in deeply rooted ways, but then there are always some cracks and always some new openings that lend themselves to further analysis. And that's really what marks the importance of our work. And sort of thinking about these coalitions and what you're asking, the first point that I'd like to address is this question of the state capital nexus, which I think is a very sort of nicely described idea in your introductory paper with Ida and Guldem as well. And kind of thinking through what might be different in the Hungarian context in this state capital nexus in comparison to a lot of international examples, just to give you a little bit of an idea of what's going on in Hungary in terms of the state capital nexus, is that in terms of urban governance, there's a strong and ongoing trend of centralization where the state really seizes control of all things that is to do with public administration, municipal duties, including perhaps, you know, thinking through the school system or public works, infrastructure maintenance, and so on. And I think what is crucial about that and how capital operates and is being recruited by the state is that there are a number of very well-established and massive firms that have been artificially inflated by the state, led by moguls and financiers who are very close to the state itself and the government, so that they can further ideological agendas and recruit capital in service of legitimizing state agendas with this particular arrangement of clientelist relations and patronage networks and rigged tendering procedures through which really there's no competition. And that sort of paints the picture of what's going on in terms of this intersection of technology and discrimination, as well as illiberalism itself. Because kind of zooming in to the case of Miskolc, and Gareth, you've obviously touched upon my work there with reference to the digital surveillance. What's really important to think about there is it's not a traditional coalition between the municipality and profiteering sort of investors and tech moguls and service providers here. But what we're seeing instead is that the state kind of positions itself against the context of post-industrial decline, where there's significant segregation and a considerable Roma population as well. But there is also a working class who are struggling to position themselves on the labor market. And the problem then is that the state tries to recruit the non-Roma working class so that the Roma can be collectively demonized. And that is done through utilizing technology and smart surveillance in a way that it will then co-opt this disillusioned crowd. And in this particular process, what we see is that there's a choice here. So technology could be recruited either to continue this superficial and symptomatic quick fixes to segregation, which is basically just about displacing crime and trying to address the symptoms in given urban quarters and just pushing it out elsewhere. Or you can recruit technology in service of social provisions, right? So social policy, you can think in terms of funding, you know, accessible educational platforms or legal advice. You can think in terms of apps like Olio, which is sort of helping people access food waste. So I think there was a choice and there still is a choice, but the problem is that technology is being utilized in a way that simply feeds into an illiberal outcome. And I think that in itself is not surprising. Unfortunately, it is quite an obvious answer, but what is new here is that the state has mobilized an immense amount of money to further what it called the Smart City project into this and channeled it into this surveillance system, even though it was embedded in a wider network of EU projects like URBAC, like Interreg, which did sort of disseminate best practices based on community development, based on bottom-up participatory governance and inclusion. And set against that backdrop, there really comes a stark contradiction that smart urbanism, even though it's a very fluid and mobile kind of policy, really has just found its way into a local dynamic of repressive and policing-based, order-based governance that just fails to address what's at the roots of that question of segregation. So I think that's one thing. One additional point, though, is that The Hungarian state isn't just thinking about its own money and its own capital. As Jason's already noted as well, that there are these master plans and these kind of incredibly sizable yet cryptic and elusive investors who seem to be, you know, working with local municipalities to draw up really shiny and attractive concepts on how to redevelop cities. And in the case of Budapest, there has been a recent example of what's been called Mini Dubai. And Mini Dubai was a proposed development by a very sort of elusive and mysterious organization by Eagle Hills LLC, and they're based in Abu Dhabi. We knew very little about them, but they were meant to develop a business district. And I think that business district was going to be really just an example of how it contradicts the ideologies of both the right-wing populist state, which claims that it wants to protect national sovereignty, and yet is doing kind of shady exchanges and businesses behind the backs against local participatory action. So it completely forecloses democracy, again, to bring in the concept of extra statecraft. And, you know, if we're thinking about the liberal response, or if it was a liberal political response, it equally would have been problematic. And in other contexts, it still is problematic, because obviously it just follows out the very inclusionary practices that it claims to further. So I think this is sort of the overall picture. And I hope I've addressed your questions in certain ways. And I could just go on forever, but conscious of time, I'll stop there.
Thanks, Miklas. No, that was really interesting. So I think from like everything you said, I think there's kind of like three things that I want to kind of follow up on with each of you. And I think it kind of falls into like three kind of categories. There's like kind of a question of like, you could call it a material question of the extent to which this type of more illiberal and authoritarian type of urbanism, I think each of you has kind of touched on this, right? How it's addressing like problems and crisis, and the extent to which it's like going to be able to like substantively address issues like housing crises, or, you know, even ecological crises, things like this, right? Like, you know, inequality, such things that are like, yeah, material kind of problems that cities face, right? Particularly when you have like out of control kind of real estate, that tends to make things pretty expensive. People tend to get angry about that, right? Can you just repress that? Or do you actually have to start doing something, right, that actually addresses some of these material problems? And I guess that kind of feeds into a second point, which is kind of about which I think we've touched on a few times that I mentioned, maintaining legitimacy when you have this kind of very antagonistic approach to governance. It requires obviously a very repressive state. Can you kind of maintain that within a sort of, especially when you still nominally have a kind of democracy in the sense that, you know, you can still vote, right? Like, is that a sort of sustainable question? A final point would be maybe thinking about the extent to which like, well, how the city kind of figures in the kind of visions of the future that these people are putting forward, these kind of right-wing positions putting forward. But I guess maybe I'll start with the first question. We will go back to high school, because that kind of, it does kind of speak most of your work, I guess. Is there a way that like these kind of more authoritarian and the liberal types of urban government are they promising something new in terms of urbanism that's going to address the like material problems such as housing shortages or costs? Is it just, you know, bolting on some more police to the people who are unhappy with that kind of the fact that these things aren't reducing? Because I think lots of different countries, we kind of often connect the kind of, and a more authoritarian turn to some sort of crisis, right? In the UK and Western Europe, it's often the financial crisis and austerity, probably the same for the US as well. In different places, maybe other kind of moments, right, that happened that led to the sort of a more authoritarian shift in kind of governance, right? So I guess, how do you see these kind of formations addressing these kind of substantive material kind of problems?
Yeah, thank you for the question. And it's a great question. And I don't think that they really have a plan or motivation to address such problems, like really address such problems. That's not, they just want to make it so that the people are still able to live in a certain poverty, or like they're accustomed to living this kind of poverty and oppression, so that they would not revolt. That is they just don't want their people to resist, that is, or resist in a way that's going to create problems for their power or for their grip on power. In terms of legitimacy, is that one thing that maybe we haven't talked about, is the fact that there is a certain populism that goes hand in hand with these kind of regimes or governances, especially if I'm going to talk in the case of Turkey, is it's not authoritarian to everybody. There is a polarization that comes with it, which actually also makes it so that you can't really see what's happening, or it is hard for a majority of the society to just blame the government or the state or the kind of tools, urban tools or otherwise tools that they use to strengthen their grasp on power, to evict more people, displace people, oppress people, etc. Because there is the fact that if you are part of their ideology, in this case, let's put it in a kind of like this, as they call it, as they used to call it, a conservative democracy, which is ironic that they put democracy in there. But if you're part of their clique, then you get a slew of democratic rights when you go to the when you're trying to develop a building as a developer, you can get your stuff done very pretty quickly with the municipality, with other kind of legal or governmental institutions. If you are just part of their ideology in terms of or their global standing in terms of women's rights, gay rights, whatever you call it, like the more conservative or traditional rights, you can go out and protest and no one's going to stop you. What you're protesting against, who knows, but you have democratic rights. That just depends on which part of the political spectrum that you position yourself. And in a way, with this kind of thing and this nationalism or the sentiment of nationalism is very important, because especially when you're trying to build consent or then reproduce that consent while you're building this huge urban mega projects, infrastructural projects. For example, in the case of Istanbul, there is a third airport, which is the biggest airport in Europe. And it is most people who probably brag about it or most of the urban poor who were kind of happy about that it was being built with their money, with the taxpayer money, is never going to be there. They're never going to use that airport, but they are happy and proud that we are building this huge infrastructure while the whole world is watching us. So there's a certain polarization and this narrative of us versus them, we're against the world. And obviously it has to go with the personalization or a cult of persona of the president, in this case Erdogan. So to be able to create this kind of consent, especially in for these big urban projects as well, you have to present them as the shining stars of Turkey and its economic development, and it's going to create jobs for you, even though in reality that does not happen. Most of the time it creates a profit and capital for the transnational real estate developers, not even the national ones necessarily. This was quite the case in a projected urban mega project, which may or may not be built. Hopefully it will never be built. Is a alternative waterway that goes, that is supposed to be built as an alternative to the Bosphorus Strait that separates Europe from Asia. But if they were to build this kind of alternative waterway, which they called Canal Istanbul, it's going to be an environmental disaster, not only for Turkey, but also for countries like Bulgaria, Ukraine, probably Russia. But it is also going to bring so much transnational capital to the country for the political and the real estate elite to share among themselves while displacing probably thousands of people and while creating an Istanbul that is naturally inhabitable in the future. So in a way, that's how they create those kind of legitimacy. But, you know, if you're not the one being displaced, if you're living in some part of Turkey and while minding your own business and you see this beautiful structure on the news that is being projected and it's going to just show the world what we are made of, then you're proud. Then you there's this kind of constant building that goes around it. So that's one way to legitimize it from the eyes of the government. And they've been using that for a really long time and they're really good at it. And they're making it so the polarization is so high, you can't really see what's happening behind the scenes. And another way, at least in terms of Istanbul and Turkey, when it comes to urban development, is depoliticizing the legal structure. So there are so many urban laws and legislations that have been changed in the last 20 to 25 years and made it almost impossible to resist in a meaningful legal way to certain projects that people are not able to rightfully so realize that what kind of rights were taken away from them legally. Because it's very hard to present to the general public, do you know what, like that's what's been happening and they're changing these laws and we need to resist that politically. It's very hard to politicize legal change, urban legal change, and kind of create attention for the general public, because it's very hard. Even when someone comes to me and talks about a certain kind of law, it takes me a while to understand what's happening. It's a very depoliticizing language, and that's obviously on purpose, and it works in the favor of the urban elite and the political elite in that case.
I think you've done a really good job of connecting, like, materiality and legitimacy. I think that's really important. And the populist aspect to it. Listeners, please go and listen to episode one. You can listen to more about that. But yeah, it's set like this very deliberate and very clear. And I think maybe Mikos, you touched on this as well. This identification of certain like privileged kind of groups of people or individuals in some cases, if it's like a business, but it was also so like a kind of state capitalist kind of thinking, right? Where it's like, you know, these are our guys. Usually one or two big companies. You know, I guess it was Elon Musk in the US for a little bit, Adani in India, like these kind of key capitalist figures are kind of selected by the state. Maybe also intermediate kind of like groups of people as well, right? Class groups or even caste groups or religious groups or whatever that are like set aside as privileged within development or, you know, within politics, basically. And I think that's, you know, part of how it can, you can kind of legitimate, yeah, I guess. So I think
it's very clear. And I guess the last bit that I could add to that is that there's also a certain, when it comes to the real estate elite, there's also kind of like certain agreement with the transnational companies and what is happening in countries that like more like Turkey or Russia or more authoritarian countries. One example is that there is a real estate development, there is that luxury residential building that was built in the middle of the forest in the north of Istanbul, complete ecocide. Before it was built, there was a forest there. And they were able to get an international LEED certificate saying that this is the green building and this is like how you're going to transition green in a green and energetically upgraded way to the future as part of like the Smart Cities initiative from Turkey. So in a way, when you look at it from outside as well, like there's a certain agreement when it comes to the real estate capital class, because they do not really care what's going on in the country. It doesn't, like, even though this comes from LEED, for example, in the United States, developers, what it kind of perpetuates is just it has to be business as usual. Political ideology or the oppression behind it does not go into these kind of debates, and somehow that makes it more legitimate in the eyes of the world as well.
That's really good. Some really interesting my examples as well, like from Istanbul. Okay, well, maybe I'll go to Oksana and then to Jason. I want to ask, because I think it was something that you talked about, Sana, which I think builds on that link between material and that legitimacy. I think when you were talking about the use of like state-run ads, I understood, right? So you've kind of got this, Jason talks about platform capitalism. Well, it kind of seems like the state is doing the platforms, right? In examples that you're talking about that perhaps in, say, the US might be done by private companies, right? Could you expand a bit on that in terms of, is this kind of service delivery is effective and stuff? Like, what is it about infrastructure that is particularly supportive for the Russian state, both either like in a national level or a local level? Like, how is it that it's, you know, is it just that they're doing stuff really well, or is it like, is there something about the way in which it's developed or the way in which it's utilized or the way in which it's like rolled out that like works towards the interests of the government or aims of the government? Mm-hmm. Or the state, I should say, rather than the government.
Well, thank you so much for your question. I think this app is state services map is like as an epitome of this type of apps. It's surprisingly effective, I would say, because bureaucracy is a huge problem for many countries, including Russia. And also bureaucracy, it's the group that supports the state, and it actually exemplifies its efficiency. And in many cases, it's like really difficult to get some services from the state if you apply in person. So it takes time, it takes effort, and especially in urban settings, it's really like long way to go and long time to wait. But when you are switching to apps, like really everything becomes much quicker, much easier. And I assume there are like some different time frames for these services. So like you apply, you complain about something in like several hours or several days, it's fixed. So, and in this case, like really state becomes a really good service provider. So, and as Aysegül mentioned, like depoliticization, it's like really important part. So state is not like this huge repressive apparatus. It's like something that works really good. As Jason mentioned, like some other apps that are not politically connotated. So that's the way. And I also think that speed, which is also, which was mentioned, it's like really a part of authoritarian regimes that we did not discuss so far because of the absence of like discussions or simple legal procedures. Let's look at some countries like new skyscrapers. They just emerge, are built like not over the night, but in several months, which is not quite possible like in many democratic countries with like labor protection laws and things like that. So I think that this apps, so they contribute to this idea that like it's efficient, it's fast, and it's like regulated by state. So state works as efficient. And let's forget that at the same time, this efficient body, so it's at war. It's actually started the war with other countries. So it's a kind of completely different way to perceive the state, which also legitimizes that. And if I may, I want to add to what you were talking about like the new developments in housing or like in urban materialities. And we quite often talk about new policies that are discriminating against some group or like making of new unprivileged. But I think it's also important in Russian case to think about new privileged ones. And it's like also might be trivial, but I think it's worth to be mentioned that it's obviously military personnel or police personnel. So it's like the new ones that are privileged in terms of housing. They are privileged through like affordable housing loans, or they are privileged through distribution. So it's not only economic logic behind that. It's rather a mixture of loyalty to regime and economic things. And before the war, there was a kind of social contract between Russian government, Russian state, and middle class. So in terms of housing provision, like really affordable loans, but apparently that's not anymore. Like for middle class, like the rates are getting higher and higher. And on the opposite, for military personnel, for police, for all these weaponized people who support the state, so they are in much more privileged situation.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So I think that's really interesting. And I think that there's something really interesting there about the role of like, and this is obviously go to Jason now as well, like I think what you talked about before, this how the platforms operate in a kind of authoritarian, illiberal kind of way, right? Is what you, the actual platform companies, at least in the US case, act in that way. And then obviously, yeah, I was talking about the state act, thinking of the same way, right? Trying to develop software or apps that prioritize this kind of efficiency, I guess, or this kind of speed. When I think about kind of discussions in the US now, both actually even from kind of more centrist kind of liberal types as well, they're kind of really focused in now on this, that the big problem that they have is that the state has become inefficient or bloated or something like that, and that's how they need to win people over, even from a more capital L liberal kind of viewpoint. Maybe to expand a bit on that and this kind of idea of like bureaucracy and then by extension like kind of urban planners or judges or like even like politicians who oppose the government are like all these kind of like blockages to getting something done, or that they're in some way trying to like undermine the people or the state. I feel like that kind of is part of legitimating kind of more authoritarian politics, I guess. And then simultaneously, like, I guess the platform operates in this way that, or digital technologies more generally operate in a way of cutting through that, I guess, in some way, right? Oh yeah. So I guess there's a kind of material and a legitimacy kind of question there, I think, maybe.
Definitely. A great example for me is like high-speed rail. And you can look at two places. Look at California, which has always been the sort of beacon of US liberalism for all its successes and failures. You could look at the UK with high-speed rail. You could look at the interplay of that with local communities, local planning processes. Both of these rail projects have been weaponized by the right, I guess, as examples of bloat, of bureaucratic failure, of a breakdown of the planning system. In both cases, there's been fierce local opposition. And then you can look at places, of course, look at even a place in the global south, like Kigali in Rwanda, which is another place I've done some research, and the way that infrastructure there is used to legitimize Paul Kagame as a sort of beacon of good governance in East Africa. They're building a new airport with Qatari capital. They have built a sort of green city in terms of eco parks in all the valleys of Kigali in the past 10 to 15 years. I suppose it's very contextual. Who is it serving? And how is who is it serving being discursively constructed either by the state or by local communities? I suppose if we move away from moral certainties, these ideas that, well, it's good that the state builds a rail line and displaces people because it's going to make for a more efficient Britain or a more efficient California. You know, it's very easy to take a side on that. But moving away from moral certainties for a minute and just looking at who is it actually serving? Like, is it serving local communities? Is it serving the facilitation of transnational capital? Is it serving the interests of the state? At what scales? And then how do those things become politicized? Maybe that's something to look at. Yeah, but Gareth, I feel like I've evaded your question.
No. I think that's even important, because I think it does link to, like, you know, this question of who is privileged through this more overt picking of winners from the state. I guess that's sort of intertwined to some extent with bureaucracy understood as like deliberation, basically. Like that it's that you would actually, when it comes to anything like a project, you might actually consider alternatives or something from rather than just kind of do what, you know, whoever's captured the interest of the local, you know, politician has in. Whether that's an airport, or whether that's a railway line, or whatever, right? Like, so yeah, I think those two things kind of do kind of connect together.
Or housing, maybe housing is a better example. And you know, one of the things that is often held up as a maybe a good version of softer authoritarianism is Singapore's housing model, which is, you know, 85% of Singaporeans live in pretty good housing, and it's generally celebrated across the political spectrum. There's very few people that criticize this housing model as a form of social housing. What that housing model has are defined ratios of ethnicity, where each new development has to have a certain percentage of Chinese, Malay, Indian, and then other residents. And in Singapore, that kind of works in the nation building agenda of that particular context. When you take that outside of Singapore, it becomes very different, that form of infrastructure. So look at what I think is it Malmo in Sweden, or maybe it's in Denmark, have tried to institute a similar system with ratios of certain ethnic groups of migrants. And it looks really out of context in that place. It looks very far right and quite reactionary. So yeah, that just goes back to my point about context and who it's serving. And in one place, it can be quite empowering, perhaps. In another, it can be quite repressive and reactionary.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, even in the UK, that there's some of these discussions now happening about social housing and access by different groups of people, immigrant groups or people who are perceived to be immigrants, I think, really, in terms of right-wing discourse and how, like, access to those things. But I guess that also comes back, certainly in the UK, everyone thinking about European context, there just seems to be the case of, like, everything of the state and services that is, like, quite often now weaponized. I mean, I think it has been weaponized quite a lot historically, but it feels like that's really kind of reaching a point that I don't think we've seen, certainly in the UK, for like quite a long time now, this definitive like idea that there needs to be a kind of separating of access by ethnic, racial, and to some extent class lines as well, like in a quite distinct way. A lot of the stuff we've talked about today is kind of things that are not like, oh my God, the state suddenly started doing this. It's more, no, they're actually just being quite open about it now. And they're just saying, right, we're just going to do this, rather than like, and a sort of a more elaborate kind of discursive separation, I guess. maybe I just come to you then for maybe this kind of third question, because I think it kind of does relate to some stuff about both your paper, Jason, and also smart cities, I think. I wanted to ask about how is like cities or maybe urban space more generally kind of figured within kind of liberal, I wouldn't say maybe ideology is the word, or like visions, or like of either the future or indeed of how things are operating today. I thought about like how like fascist politics in the 20th century was kind of very anti-urban, like explicitly it was, you know, very much about the countryside and the people and the real people and the towns and the countryside, versus the liberal city, right? The liberal city was very liberal and you know, seen as a dangerous for that reason, right? I think today you're starting to see that from right-wing politicians, right? Cities is and it, you know, again, not entirely new, that cities, even though they have relatively low crime rates, are crime-ridden, and they're places of, again, this kind of weak, like kind of liberal governments. If you think of like how New York and San Francisco and obviously very explicitly at the moment, Los Angeles is like being figured in the US context. I'd just be interested to hear what you think about like how the city is kind of figured in that way, right? How it's kind of discussed and understood as a kind of either a future vision, like how this kind of more liberal politics wants cities to be, and how it kind of problematizes cities, I guess, as a kind of means of its politics.
To stick to the example of railways, there's quite an interesting and quite relevant and timely example for that in terms of how railway systems could also demonstrate and signify the ways in which visions of authoritarian urban governance might take place. And just looking across the Asian continent, we've been witnessing several of those, especially, you know, there's been this example in India, you might have heard of it, where approximately 200,000 people were displaced from along railway tracks in Delhi. And that was a result of the sort of railway company's idea that they want to maintain tracks and ensure sort of environmental cleanliness and safety and order along the tracks. I think it really resonates with those populist ideas of order and of organization and cleanliness and safety and so on and so forth. And I think more generally, there's two major trends that I'd highlight when it comes to authoritarian urban engineering and architectural and spatial arrangements. And the first one, I suppose, is to do with what's been mentioned, I think, before, is this idea of megastructures and things that have got to sort of last, and things, I think, from the Russian and as well as the Turkish examples. There is a couple of similar trends going on in Hungary, particularly, and you know, saddeningly or strange enough, in the form of football stadiums. And football stadiums are being touted by the regime as an important way in which national pride is being furthered at national and international football events. And despite the fact that a lot of money is being channeled into new stadiums, and even second division teams are getting beautiful and internationally competitive looking structures, that the results don't follow along. But I think what's much more important about this is a statement by the government to show that sport is a method through which people can be brought together, that support can be rallied. And if we as a country and members of this imagined community come together and go to the stadium and support the team, that will, of course, create spaces for engagement with our national pride, right? And I think that part about megastructures and of building great things is also something memorable. Again, these probably will to stand the test of time, and it will therefore mark this era of top-down illiberal right-wing populist nationalist forms of government. And the second part, I think, is also really important, is this notion of safety, security, order, cleanliness, tidiness, and the rest, which come to structure urban space. And I think one method that strikes me, especially when we look at municipalities in Hungary that are being led by the current government party, Fidesz, is this excess use of concrete, which might sound a little bit strange, but public spaces, you know, greens, parks, all of them are being paved off, because that way they become more transparent, less prone to what are commonly construed as unsociable forms of behavior or antisocial forms of behavior. And at the same time, there is this narrative that they can be surveilled and police can go up and down and sort of control them more easily. And I think when it comes to such forms of placemaking, this aesthetic beautification, or, well, it's in the eye of the beholder, really, whether it's beautification, but at least from the perspective that the marginalized and the scapegoated groups are being displaced and contained and policed, I think what the regime ultimately wants to achieve is that they showcase their power, they demonstrate that contrary to what the liberals are able to do, we are creating these very sanitized, transparent, easy to navigate in safe spaces. All the rest are obviously not being dealt with at the same time. So all the rest of the marginalized populations and the scapegoats are just sort of being pushed out of these spaces. The homeless are being punished. Although right now in Budapest, there is a liberal government who are more sort of pro-homeless and pro-empowerment. That leads to a lot of clashes between the national government and the municipality of Budapest. But I think what it does come down to, it kind of links back to the smart surveillance example in Miskolc as well, is that the CCTVs were also there to take the symptoms of the perceived wrongly defined and sort of really demonized kinds of behavior from public spaces that were seen as the cause and the root of the problems, be it poverty, be it decline in terms of the physical fabric of the city, but also in terms of the political sort of socio-political landscape in general. So I think we need to think about, at the end of the day, is that authoritarian governments try and utilize capital, not necessarily to create profit, at least not in the Hungarian context, but rather to utilize that capital to perpetuate their political hegemony so that they can rally more support and they can really channel that money into the real estate mega corporations, who can then be commissioned with more and more building projects, again, to legitimize state power and not to generate profit for the private sector. So the state is really at the center of all this, and its attempt to refuel itself every time they do something like that.
Thank you. Yeah, that's really interesting. I think you reminded me actually of when you were talking about that, actually, the football stadium that they're supposed to be building for the Saudi World Cup, which is supposed to be, I don't know if it's in neon, but it's definitely like in a new development that has like, it's supposed to be suspended in the air or something like this. I'm like, that's, yeah, like, this kind of iconoclastic kind of like project, that kind of idea of a space that's like kind of surveilled and clean and ordered and all those kind of things, right? That kind of mashed into one, right? I guess kind of like reminded me a bit also of neon, I guess, is that kind of this kind of, and almost like those, what you often see online, which I feel like is the kind of ultimate image of this, is like there's AI generated like cityscapes that right-wing groups like to share, which are like, you know, completely devoid of people usually. Including that really like terrifying and gross one of like Gaza that Trump and Netanyahu were like kind of promoting, like, but they kind of almost the AI generated image of that is kind of the this kind of like future vision I think that some of these people have. I think that's probably time to bring it to an end. If people want to follow up on the participants in this podcast, like there'll be information in the show notes, links to writing papers, and of course the special issue that kind of led to us doing the podcast in the first place with Jason and Miklos, you can read in there, but obviously Oksana and Isigul will have your links to your work and things that you've talked about today in there. I just want to thank you all for taking the time to share your work and your research and to discuss this today. Thank you all for listening, and please do check out the other podcasts if you haven't. Thank you.
Thanks to you for listening. For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.